Welcome to Let's Talk, brought to you live by the National Indigenous Radio Service, the only opportunity offered to the broader community to be informed on the issues and current affairs from a First Nations perspective. This is Carver Watson with Let's Talk.
We acknowledge the sovereignty of all First Nations people right across the country, in particular the local traditional owners, the Yuggera, Turrbal, Yugaripal, Yugambeh, Combermary, Gubbi Gubbi and Quandamooka people of Southeast Queensland. We also welcome all of our listeners tuned in across the National Indigenous Radio Service, and wherever you are, if you're streaming via the web or at any time if you're listening on the podcast. We're in the studio this morning in Brisbane. After a wonderful, wonderful game last night, and joined by, do you go for New South Wales, Mr. Chris Graham?
Mate, is this the football? Is that what you're referring
to? Yes.
I sort of do go for Queensland, because New South Wales never picked black fellas, and Queensland have always got black fellas, so I think that might explain the 10 straight losses we endured recently.
Well, apparently they were saying last match that there was more Indigenous players in the New South Wales team. That's why they won.
Oh, there you go. Yeah. Well, there is an undeniable pattern. I used to be dyed-in-the-wool New South Wales. I've got the jumper and everything. I used to turn up and scream and carry on. But they consistently refused to pick very good Indigenous players. And so I eventually switched to Queensland.
Some might call that racist, Chris Graham.
Undeniably. At least I'm open about my hypocrisy.
Did you watch last night's game?
No, I didn't.
You missed a marvellous, absolutely. It was epic.
Yeah.
Absolutely epic. Jonathan Thurston's return to the squad after being away from injury.
Yeah.
They were down 16-6 at half time, and they came out. Yeah, in the second half, and they won the second half 12 points. To nil, 18-16.
Shadows of Willie Kahn's great last-minute try, I presume. The one New Queenslanders still go on about from the early 90s.
Is that the one?
The one with the forward pass.
What about that one, Sterlo?
That was the one with the forward pass that won you a State of Origin series. And,
Now it comes out. You're a Blue supporter.
It does. Just scratch the surface and it comes back.
It's just poke and prod.
You guys understand. It's you love who you love, even if you try hard not to love them.
It was an epic game. And they're calling it Thurston's last Origin series. I'm not up to whether or not he's actually announced that, but they're saying it is his last series, as well as Cooper Cronk.
Yeah.
And so to come back from one down and win down there like that,
and it was a frogging, wasn't it? I didn't see the first one either. But
the first one
hiding.
Was a hiding. Yeah, it was a touch up. It was 24 to something.
But you guys were missing most of your top players, I think. Well, JT wasn't there.
It was the traditional squad missing Thurston and Slater. Yeah. And so Slater returned last game and Thurston returned this game as well.
Yeah, right.
Well, mate, now we've spoken about the important stuff, I forgot to start with your introduction. Chris Graham of New Matilda.
New Matilda fame or infamy. I'm a Sydney boy, born and bred. Scottish, Irish, Māori heritage. And the Māori heritage, I was looking it up last night again, is from sort of Mutter Mutter, Waikato. I was reading about the wars with the British last night, just randomly. But that's where my family comes from. White boy raised in Sydney and roots back to NZ and Scotland and Ireland.
And an avid New South Wales supporter, apparently.
Yeah, well, don't let that get out of I've moved to Queensland. I don't care about it anymore. I think I did walk away, partly because of the Super League stuff. I was actually living here in Queensland when the Super League war broke out. I was working at the Brother St. Brendan's Football Club at Salisbury.
Yeah, I was just off by Desert Road.
Yeah. I was back there for a wake recently.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, that was over 20 years ago. But that's when the Super League war broke out. I think it was about 95, thereabouts, 94, 95. And kind of turned off league then. Just went, I'm not really into this anymore.
Mm.
But still followed the State of Origin.
State of Origin famously wasn't part of Super League, was it?
No. They tried to have a series, and I can't remember what they called it. But, I mean, in the end, Super League won, obviously, because we've got the NRL. But I loved footy growing up. I was obsessed with it, and I'm one of those guys who would watch State of Origin very passionately, but I'd turn down Ray Hadley because he does your head in, and turn up Roy and HG because they're legends. And State of Origin for me and my family in Sydney was huge. It was just there's no bigger event in the year. But now I don't even watch it.
I'm not on Facebook, but you know. The missus is in the commentary of on Facebook around Origin time. It's play by play.
It is, isn't it?
Yeah. It's quite extraordinary. And it's, you know, it is still a big thing. But, I mean, today we still have, you know, one-eyed game callers.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Fatty Vorton. Go, Manly, go, Manly. And Peter Sterling. Parramatta.
Gus Gould.
Gus Gould, yeah.
He always, like, you know, yeah.
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 I'm not a fan of Gus Gould either. But the commentary team, I'm just generally not a fan of. I don't know. Is Ray Hadley. Is it Ray Hadley? No, he's not a caller. Who's the.
I don't think so.
Who's it? Rabs Warren.
Yeah, the old bloke, yeah.
Is he still calling?
Yeah.
God, I can't. I just can't. I can't do it. Promote the ball. Turn it up, the Vietnam.
It's the voice of rugby league, mate. It's just children all over the. I was going to say country, but it's, you know, Queensland, New South Wales, at least hear their name being called out in that that exact voice.
Turn it up. Oh, come on, man. I can't stand it, and it actually gives me goosebumps talking about it. But they're bad goosebumps. I can't stand his. I can't stand him. He just does my head in. But I've got a genuine affection for Queensland. I mean, I think JT is an extraordinary player, just a phenomenal player. I think he's the complete player. I know you guys just gone on about Alfie Langer and
the King.
Yeah, the King, Wally. And who was the one? Who was the Lockyer? You've produced the greatest footballers. I think there's not much doubt about that, but. I just think Thurston's phenomenal. So,
you didn't watch the game. So they tied it up with the last try. Thurston had to kick with 2 minutes left to win the game.
He's done that before, though. He's a freak. He's just, I'm not an expert on it, so I don't claim to be, and I haven't followed it that closely for years, but I, from what I've seen of Thurston, I think he's just the complete player. He's a freak. When I had a bit to do with the league players in Sydney, I had a bit to do with Inglison. Inglis didn't play last night. He's out for a year or something.
He's out for a while, yeah.
Yeah, he's seriously hurt himself. I just think Thurston's phenomenal, and he's a great role model. He's one of those players who, correct me if I'm wrong, but he's stayed pretty much scandal-free, which is no mean feat in the NRL. So I quite, you know, if Thurston has a win, I'm quite happy about it.
And it's hopefully, you know, being the last Origin season, they've certainly set up a great fairy tale ending if the decider comes off. So
well, and look, in all honesty, don't tell my friends in New South Wales this, but if this is Thurston's last game and it's the decider, I'd rather see Thurston win it. And I think, if you're to be honest, even though New South Wales supporters, we're not as insanely passionate as Queensland supporters. You guys have...
Leave it at passionate, mate.
Yeah, your synapses misfire up here. It's weird to watch, you know, like it's strange. We kind of go, calm down, all right, just it's a footy game. But I think most New South Wales people would be, if they lost, they'd be happy to lose it on Thurston's last game because he's respected in New South Wales as well.
We'll wrap up the footy talk, but you just reminded me of the grand final of Cowboys and Broncos 2 years ago.
Yeah, that Thurston did it then, didn't he?
No, he missed the kick, but he got the drop goal for Golden Point. But I remember, you know, avid Broncos supporters telling me the story. You know, they're sitting around watching him lining up this kick to win the game, and of course they're mad Broncos fans, but they. Yeah. My brother-in-law said, he looked at his mate, and he looked at his mate and he said, we want to see him kick this, don't we?
It's because it's Thurston. The only player I was going to say who I probably like more than and respect more than Thurston would be Tamana Tahu, and that's because of Tahu's stance against the racism of the New South Wales.
But he's always been connected with community too and always made himself available.
Genuine. Lovely guy.
Yeah, goes to the footy carnivals, plays with the mob, and is very connected. Yeah,
a lot of them do. So did Mundine. I remember when I came up to Queensland in the early 2000s to the first contact carnival. That was the first carnival I came to, the first footy carnival. Mundine was here having a run around the park with the boys. Half the NRL players were.
Mm.
A lot of them still turn up for the knockout. Tamana Tahu was at the knockout before last, I think. I just think Tamana Tahu is an extraordinary individual to take the stand he did. And for those who don't remember what it was some racial epithets being screamed in the Blues dressing room about, I think it was Inglis, they were going off about. And I can't even remember who the coach was that was screaming, and I've got a feeling it was...
Johns.
Andrew Johns, that's right. Yeah. Yeah, it was. And and Tamana Tahu said non-acceptable, took a stand, and quit the team. And I don't think it was ever picked.
Walked out.
And I don't think it was ever picked in a state of origin. I could be wrong. He might have got one more Guernsey after that. But, I mean, he was an exceptionally good player in his own right, and he walked away from Origin on a matter of principle. And I think Thurston's a fantastic player, but you don't see players, certainly in the NRL, take that kind of moral stand very often. You see it very occasionally in the AFL. Michael Long did, Nicky Widmar did.
Goodsy?
Goodsy's absolutely, he's the kind of king of them all. And now Eddie Betts is taking a stand. But you don't see it in the NRL very often, which is disappointing. But Tamana Tahu did it, so.
I heard somebody, I follow, as you know, because I incessantly talk about it, I follow the NBA pretty closely.
Yes, and this is the basketball for people who don't know what the hell you're talking about.
But I heard in one of the podcasts I listened to, the sports is described the great meritocracy. Would you agree with that statement?
It is. It is to some degree. I mean, it's as close as you'll get, particularly in Australia. It's the most level playing field. And one of the really interesting things is that Indigenous people are overrepresented in sport. Like, they're overrepresented in the draft, the AFL draft. They're massively overrepresented. And they're overrepresented in the Australian, in the National Rugby League as well. And it is a level playing field. So, but I've talked about this many, many times with people. And there's a lot of white fellas have got this theory that Aboriginal people are just innately better at sport, and I think that's partly true. You look at the NBA, absolutely dominated by
African American
players. I mean, completely dominated.
You know they outruled slam dunking once in the NBA?
Yeah, I remember that because bloody African Americans were too good.
They keep dunking on everyone. That's illegal. You can't do that.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. That's like it's like banning the sidestep in league. No more. Stop running around us. Yeah, but I think it's a combination of nature and nurture. This is my personal theory. There may be nothing to it. I think Aboriginal people are naturally more athletic than non-Aboriginal people. But you have a different upbringing to non-Aboriginal people. Bushville, as I know, this is not so much the case today, but certainly in years gone by, the mob didn't have access to the PlayStation and the Xbox, and they were sent out to play a lot more. So you developed skills they had to, because that's how they got around. When I was growing up, we didn't sit in front of the television very much. We certainly didn't play on Facebook or anything. But if you look at Aboriginal communities in Central Australia, they spend their days outdoors because that's all they've got to do. So I think it's a bit of nature and nurture. But on the level playing field, it's undeniably more level. It's not entirely level. Because you see what people like Goods and Betts and Tamana Tahu and others face in the sporting field.
And
Mundine's one of the great ones.
You mentioned Mundine before. He walked away from
league because it was so racist, yeah. I mean...
correct me if I'm wrong, but I recall it was to do with New South Wales selections.
Yeah, he couldn't get into the New South Wales State of Origin team. He could barely get into the Australian side either. And people have different theories about it, but about whether or not he was, there were other really good 5'8s going around at the time. I think Laurie Daly, he was up against Laurie Daly. I don't know if that's true.
Jonathan Thurston couldn't get a run behind, who was that Cronulla halfback?
Camorley. Brett Camorley, yeah. I know. It's pretty hard to justify, isn't it? Camorley was a good player, but you look at Thurston, I mean, there's no comparison, really. I won't name names, but there was a selector, and I won't name teams either, who has been around a long time and was undeniably hated Aboriginal people. Undeniably. I've got, if I had ever had to come out and prove it, I could. And just hated Bayfellas. And so, was in a position to seriously influence whether or not Aboriginal people were picked. Now, that's not so much the case today, but undeniably, there are Aboriginal players have missed out on opportunities because they're Aboriginal. And people will say, you know, people will knock Anthony Mundine's ability, which is pretty ridiculous. I mean, you know, he's a pretty good player. Whether you like him or hate him, he's a pretty good player. So they'll say, well, he wasn't a team player, which is code for he's a loudmouth black. You know, we don't mind the blacks as long as they keep their mouth shut.
There's a documentary series at the moment, again, American basketball, Lakers and Celtics, Best of Enemies. And it was a huge, huge rivalry during the sort of through the 70s into the 80s. And it became this unspoken understanding that it was the Lakers being Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, who was very sort of political. But you know, African-American and, you know, black power. You know, you had Irving Magic Johnson, who was very flashy and skillful and you know, up against people like Larry Bird. And who was the other black? There's another black in there. I'll think of him after. But, you know, so L.A., which had a huge African American population, whereas Boston's very blue collar, working class,
white. Boston.
And that was the language.
Irish Catholic.
Yeah.
Boston,
yeah. But that was the language. It was never about black and white. It was about, oh, they're Showtime flashy. They don't do hard work and play the fundamentals.
Yeah.
And it's a similar sort of language when you'd hear people talk about whether it be mundane or stuff being too flashy or.
Yeah,
they don't go to the game plan or selfish or whatever whatever it is, you know.
Yeah, look, I've seen Mundine play. I remember some of the greatest feats I've seen performed on an NRL field have been performed by black fellas. I remember Nathan Blacklock scoring a try in the grand final for St George, and I can't remember who he was playing. I think he was playing against Melbourne. It was years ago in Sydney, and he just ran onto the ball. It was a bomb, and it bounced awkwardly, and he just hit it at such a speed. It was freakish to watch. And I remember writing about it at the time and thinking at the time that only Aboriginal players get away with those sorts of plays because they've got the confidence to try it. And it's flashy, and it is, but they've got that confidence. You know, that's... You don't see white fellas pull that stuff off very much. You look at Andrew Johns. He wasn't a flashy player, but you look at Thurston, you know, he's, you know, he's one of the just, he's, Thurston's not that flashy either, but he's just a all-round talented player.
He's got a vision for the game, though. He sort of sees things before they happen. He understands the right angles for people to run and everything. It's like in basketball, they call it a basketball IQ. He's just got an IQ for the game.
He does. And one of my personal theories on, and look, I've experienced this personally. This is going to sound like a sob story. It's obviously not. But Mundine polarised Australians so much that he became the great excuse for racism without being overtly accused of overt racism. I remember watching Mundine's fight, the first fight against Danny Green, at a pub in Canberra. It was an Irish club.
There's a lot of lead up to that, though.
Oh, there
You're
was.
Glossing over probably 5 years of
Oh,
Mundine's.
More than 5 years. Oh, look, they hated him. And the point I was going to make is it became okay. If you wanted to express a view about Aboriginal people in Australia who didn't want to be accused of being racist, you could just attack Anthony Mundine. And you could pretend, oh, it's not about the fact that he's black, it's the fact that he's Anthony Mundine. I hate Anthony Mundine. I don't hate blacks, I just hate Anthony Mundine, which is complete rubbish. It was code for, I hate blacks, but I'm not allowed to talk about them like that. But I am allowed to talk about Anthony Mundine like this. And that actually became something that happened in my extended family, not my immediate family, but my... I was a foster kid and then adopted kid, and I went back and found my family, who ironically have Aboriginal. My stepmother is Aboriginal. My sisters are Aboriginal. My brother's Aboriginal. In that kind of extended family, because I wrote for the National Indigenous Times, I was engaged in Aboriginal affairs. It became you couldn't take me on about that stuff because A, I'd tear you to pieces, and B, that would be pretty rude. So instead, there were certain family members who were just consistently niggle me about Anthony Mundine. And I'm thinking, why are you... I barely even know Anthony Mundine. I met him a handful of times. Why are you... Every time they see me, they raise Anthony Mundine. And it was because that's their way of being racist without... That's their way of getting away with being racist. It's kind of... sad, really. But, you know, it's, I think it's to Mun Noon's great, to his great credit. It doesn't mean that everything he said is sacrosanct. He said some incredibly stupid things, Mun Noon. His comment about it's Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, one of the most ridiculous, offensive comments. I mean, he made a fool of himself, and he's done that a few times. But
without getting into the political statements and stuff, you know, a lot of people have spoken a long time about he's marketed and done extremely well of the fact of people wanting to pay.
Hate me.
Yeah, for people to pay per view. They will go and spend money and put their credit card details in to watch him hopefully get knocked
out. Get flogged, yeah. Well, I was mentioned that I went to the first fight with Mun Noon. I didn't detect it so much at the second fight, but I didn't really follow it. But the first fight was, you know, the fight of the century from an Australian perspective, Danny Green versus Anthony Mun Noon. And I was in the Irish club. It was a weeknight, so it was a school night. In theory, it shouldn't have been, you know, two-packed. You had to sit on the floor in this place. It was absolutely packed, and every club in Canberra was. And of the hundreds of people packed into the Irish club, there were three people going for Anthony Mun Noon. There was me, my neighbour, who I went to the fight with, and over in the corner was a sole single black fella who could tell I was going for Mun Noon, and I could tell he was, because when Mun Noon came on, you know, we're the only ones going, yay. And so we kind of, you know, nodded to each other. I'm sure most people would have detected this, and if you didn't, then you're subhuman. But the chanting and the crowd aggression towards Mun Noon went way beyond a sporting match. It wasn't about, you know, I don't like this person as a sportsman, and I really like Danny Green as a sportsman, and I hope that Danny is victorious, but that everyone has a good match and boxing is the winner here today. That's not what went on at all. What went on was just baying and screaming for Mun Noon's blood, and it was a kind of explosion of latent Australian hatred and racism, which, frankly, I thought was brilliant, because it spoke volumes about where we were at a nation, and I think it's maybe improved a little bit, but Mun Noon, you can thank for that. And, you know, he's made a squillion dollars out of it. Good luck to him. But I don't imagine it would have been an easy road to walk.
No. I remember after that fight on the news that there were multiple altercations and fights
everywhere.
That occurred.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Around the country.
Because
it was that sort of contentious.
Polarising, yeah. And, you know, if Australians were honest, and they're not, if you look at the social media chatter around Mun Noon, people still consistently maintain it's not because they don't like Aboriginal people, it's that they don't like Mun Noon. It's a kind of metaphor for Australian racism, which has really been perfectly kind of cooked and moulded so that it's very difficult racism to wrap your head around. You know, I often talk about this. In fact, I was talking about it again last night on the subject that we're supposed to be talking about, which is the Northern Territory Intervention, but we'll get to that. South African apartheid was actually, a lot of Australians don't know this, but it was actually based on the Queensland Protection Act. So the South African officials came to Queensland. Yeah.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. South African officials came to Queensland to see how Aboriginal, how white Australian governments controlled
Aboriginal people. In Queensland.
And they based it on the Queensland Protection Act. That's the basis of South African apartheid. That's a shocking fact in its own right. But one of the things that I forgot where I was going. What were we talking about?
We're talking about Mun Noon and the assaults that occurred following the Danny Green and Mun Noon fight.
Oh, I had a point to make about, you know, based on apartheid. I've talked myself out of it because of the extraordinariness of the of the fact that apartheid's based on Queensland protection laws.
How did we? Yes, very good. Go Queensland.
Yeah. Go Queensland. Well, that's the thing, and that's what a lot of people don't realise. There's a lot of reasons why Queensland's perceived the way it is. That's not well known. But, you know, you've got JB Occhi-Peterson. That doesn't help your cause particularly. I can't remember the point I was trying to make about apartheid and Mun Noon, other than to say Mun Noon makes Australians feel like it's okay to be racist without really being caught for being racist. Actually, that's the point I was going to make. Apartheid South Africa, the whites there were 10% of the population. The blacks were 90% of the population. When you're outnumbered like that, you need overt control mechanisms that oppress people in brutal and overt ways. Because if you don't, you'll get overrun. In Australia, over time, white people became the majority. Aboriginal people became the minority. So we didn't need the same overt racial controls. We could achieve the same end that they achieved in South Africa with more subtle racism. And that's really one of the great things, and I use the term sarcastically, one of the great things about Australian racism is its subtlety. We didn't need to put a sign on it that said, you know, blacks sit on the back of the bus. We just created an economic circumstance where either the blacks couldn't afford to get on the bus, or if they could, they didn't want to be there because they felt so socially isolated. And we created a system where, you know, we still had those overt controls. You know, we had roped off sections in movie theatres. We had people needed permits to, Aboriginal people needed permits to come into towns. You know, if you spoke your language or you didn't do what you were told, you were shipped off to Palm Island. So we still used those overt controls, but we didn't need to do it as much as and as brutally and as openly as as oppressively, because it's equally oppressive. But we didn't need to do it the way that the South Africans did, because it wasn't a matter of being overrun by numbers. And that's sort of where I was going with Mundine. There's a beautiful subtlety about Australian racism when they deal with Mundine. You can't prove, if I say to you, oh, I don't hate Aboriginal people, I just hate Mundine, you can't prove I'm lying. You can get a general feel for it. You can go, yeah, I've got a feeling you might be one of those, but you can't prove it. And that's the brilliance of Australian racism. You can't prove it. You can't prove that I think a particular way. And Australians have been getting away with that for years, and Mundine really is the kind of great escape for white racism. He just makes it okay to scream the stuff you want to say about Aboriginal people generally. You can't say that, but you can say it about Mundine, and that feels almost as good, which is, you know, a bit sad, but that's the basis of Australian existence.
And look, we've had people all throughout history who've, you know, posed those questions and created that sort of discussion, and as we spoke about, Goods in his own way has raised similar sentiments and similar discussions around becoming that focal point for an unspoken sense of what would you call it, prejudice.
Yeah, Goods is you're right, you're exactly right. Goods is, I think Goods, you know, I'm sure I've said this before, I think the sun may shine out of Adam Goods's bum. I didn't think that years ago. I thought, because he was on the National Indigenous Council, and I thought it was quite disgraceful. I was very suspicious of his politics, et cetera, et cetera. But to endure what he endured, you're exactly right. It's exactly the same scenario. You can't prove I don't like Aboriginal people. I just don't like Adam Goods. What's not to like about Adam Goods? Like, he's the same as Mundine. He's a role model. He doesn't drink. He's a role model for kids. He doesn't smoke. He's respectful. He has a charity that helps children. People go, oh, no, on the sporting field, he's X, Y, and Z. That's just rubbish. I mean, the statistics show he's not a dirty player. He's won best and fairest, I think, twice. But you still
and widely respected.
And widely respected by other players. Yeah. I mean, the movement behind Goods from other AFL players was substantial. They took their time, I think. They took their sweet time, but there was a substantial move behind Goods, so he's obviously highly respected by the players. But again, I can put all the evidence in front of you want that Adam Goods is a fair and decent player and an excellent role model. But you can say to me, well, I still don't like Adam Goods, and I can't prove you're talking about Aboriginal people generally, but we both know you are. And that was the debate. I remember the debate really well that raged around Australia. It went on for over a year because Goods was, I think it was 18 months that Goods was hounded out of football.
I think there was a story even not long ago about, you know, is the sun setting on racism in AFL. And, you know, we're still talking about it. And I think it'll be talked about for a long, long time in terms of Australian history. But look, we are running out of time. But I will reemphasise the fact that there was another great role model last night in Jonathan Thurston, and an entire state was wheeling that ball along with him over that crossbar. So congratulations again to Queensland. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about the intervention, which is 10 years old yesterday.
Yesterday, yeah.
The Northern Territory intervention. Yes, you're listening to Let's Talk. We're speaking with Chris Graham, and we'll be back in a moment.
Hi, I'm Jonathan Thurston. You know, in football, they say it's important to get off to a good start, and the same thing counts for our kids. That's why kindy is so important. It sets them up for a better future. Get your kids to kindy. It's a deadly choice.
If your child turns 4 before June 30 next year, they can start kindy in January. Get your free kindy kit when you have a health check at your local clinic. For more info, visit deadlykindies.com.au, an initiative of the Institute for Urban Indigenous Health.
Station sponsor.
Stop drinking.
reckon is hard drinker. He reckon is hard drinker. He reckon is hard drinker.
This is Carver Watson with Let's Talk.
It is Carver Watson with Let's Talk, and I'm joined by New Matilda, editor, and man of many talents and infamy, Chris Graham.
Thank you.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm there, I believe. I was playing around with the panels here, but I know I'm not supposed to.
Yeah, just keep your hands off the buttons, mate.
That
we were just talking about being nervous about Donald Trump having his finger on the button.
Yeah, true. Or
his phone for that matter, in which he can't spell, and he spelt Kafefe instead of biased.
Yeah. Well, he's trying to spell coverage, and it ended up as C-O-V-F-E-F-E.
Kafefe.
It's forever a word now in the English language, which I love. It's one of my favourite words. That and pineapples.
Very good.
No reason.
But we were speaking about, or we came here today to speak about the 10 years since the Northern Territory intervention. And, Chris Graham, you've obviously been around and covering Indigenous affairs for 10 years now.
Yep.
And some. Can you recap for our listeners, you know?
What happened?
How did leading up and what sort of, why was the Northern Territory intervention invoked?
Well, it's 10 years. Yesterday was 10 years to the day, a decade to the day that Howard and John Howard and Mal Brough stood up in a press conference and announced they were intervening. They were sending the army into Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory. It's actually 11 years to the day that an alleged story broke that actually sparked it. So in 2006, ABC Late Line sort of embarked on a campaign of reporting around sexual violence in Aboriginal communities in the Northern Territory. They broke a big story based on the comments of a prosecutor from Alice Springs called Nanette Rogers. Excuse me. And that story, for some reason, just gathered enormous pace. It became a massive issue. And about a month or so later, I think it was 6 weeks later, they then broke another story about the community of Mutajulu, which, for those who don't know, is in the shadow of Uluru. The allegation by ABC Late Line was that Mutajulu, the core allegation was that there's an elderly, that children were being traded between communities as sex slaves, that sexual violence from Aboriginal men was rampant and widespread, and that, excuse me, in the case of Mutajulu, there was an alleged elderly paedophile who was abusing children, and an environment had been created by other men in that community where he's able to get away with it. They were the central allegations. And the day after that story aired, the very next morning, Claire Martin, the then Chief Minister of the Northern Territory, announced the Little Children a Sacred report. So it's a six-month inquiry into sexual violence in Aboriginal communities. Little Children, a Sacred report was handed down, and 6 weeks after that, the federal government announced the Northern Territory intervention on the basis that the Little Children, a Sacred report uncovered widespread sexual abuse in Aboriginal communities. That's not what it did at all.
I was just going to ask that. What was in the report?
No, it uncovered all sorts of issues. It uncovered issues of abuse and neglect. Excuse me. It uncovered. I've got a bit of the end of the flu. It uncovered views from Aboriginal communities that education standards weren't being met, that all sorts of things. Housing was poor, it was overcrowding. It looked at a whole raft of things. And the authors of the report, Pat Anderson and Rex Wilde, have both come out since and publicly said that the Howard government completely misrepresented the Little Children of Sacred report. So that's not really in dispute. They're the authors of the report. So that ABC Late Line story sparked the Little Children of Sacred report, which was the basis of the launching of the Northern Territory intervention. Now, the ABC has always denied any responsibility for the Northern Territory intervention, but the link is undeniable and mm-hmm. widely acknowledged. In fact, it's widely acknowledged by politicians as well that it was ABC's reporting that led to the intervention. That's been stated publicly numerous times by numerous politicians. The problem is that that story was a fiction from start to finish. Everything about it.
You're on record as saying as much.
I've been trying to get these people to sue me now for a decade, and they won't. And I argue they won't sue me because everything I've published is factual, and it is. There's no dispute about what we've uncovered in the story. And to give you a broad kind of fit, there was a witness in that story whose face was blacked out and his voice was digitised to hide his identity. He was called a former youth worker, supposed to have been based in Mutajulu. His name was Gregory Andrews. He wasn't a youth worker. He was a senior advisor to Mal Brough. And he was someone who actually advised the minister that there was widespread sexual abuse in Aboriginal communities.
That doesn't sound right.
It's pretty, yeah. Look, it gets worse because Gregory Andrews, having been given anonymity by ABC Late Line, who knew he worked for Mal Brough, they were going to interview him and liaised with the departmental media office for the interview. They were going to interview him in Canberra in his office at the Office of Indigenous Policy Coordination, which is Brough's chief's agency then. Having given him anonymity, Andrews then grossly embellished his story. It was quite extraordinary how badly he embellished his story. We got leaked the talking points of what he told Mal Brough he was going to say on this interview. And bear in mind, of course, Mal Brough's always maintained he was never told Andrews was going to talk, but we've got the talking points that show Brough was lying. Those talking points, Andrews, having been given anonymity, completely embellishes the story. And he's at one point is actually weeping on camera as he describes how all of the incidents of sexual violence against children that he saw, against women and children that he saw in Mutajulu, he reported to the police. It subsequently emerged Gregory Andrews never made a single report to police of sexual violence against women or children.
Was he in community?
He lived in Alice Springs, which is hundreds of kilometres away, and sometimes he stayed at the Uluru Resort, which is 30 or 40 kilometres
away. Which is
not Mutajulu. It's nothing. You couldn't be any further removed from Mutajulu.
You could be in Alice Springs.
You could be in Alice Springs, yeah. He claimed in a Senate inquiry, he sat there and barefaced lied to a Senate inquiry, said that...
Is he a politician, this man?
No, he's now the Threatened Species Commissioner. He earns $300,000 a year as the government's Threatened Species Commissioner. He lied his way through the interview. It's not in dispute. He's not disputing that he lied. He just refuses to comment on it. He got caught. Hands down, he got caught lying. There's no denying it. But so did Late Line. One of the biggest lies Late Line told, apart from lying about who this person was, they also put a doctor on the program. And the doctor was served in Mutajulu for 3 or 4 years, I think, 4 or 5 maybe. He was the GP, and this elderly alleged paedophile at the centre of the story was a patient at the Mutajulu Health Clinic, and the doctor went, his name is Jeff Stewart, Dr. Jeff Stewart. He went on the Late Line program claiming that Aboriginal men in Mutajulu created an environment where this elderly alleged paedophile was able to sexually abuse children with impunity. So he claimed men created the environment where this is to happen. We got leaked the health records of the old man. The doctor, Jeff Stewart, was prescribing Viagra to the 67-year-old man. And at one point wrote in his health records, is using Viagra to have sex with young females. He wrote that in the health records and then continued to prescribe Viagra for another 9 months. He left the community, wrote on the front of the health records not to have Viagra anymore, so he tried to ban him from Viagra. This was 9 months after prescribing it anyway. But then subsequent doctors came into the community, ignored the notes on the man's health records and continued to prescribe Viagra. And then some years later, Jeff Stewart went on ABC Ley Line and told the nation that Aboriginal men in Mutitjulu created the environment where this man was able to abuse with impunity. In fact, Jeff Stewart had created an environment where this man was able to abuse. I mean, he was an impotent elderly man being given Viagra by a doctor who expresses concern he's using it to assault young females, but continues to prescribe it anyway. I mean, that's a pretty explosive and sensational story. We broke that story. Jeff Stewart acknowledges that that's what happened. He says that he felt pressured, et cetera, et cetera, but he doesn't deny that it happened, and he can't because we've got the health records. What is extraordinary is that Lateline knew about this. They were leaked a report, which they took the top section of the report, which supported the basic thesis of their story, and they ignored the bottom section of the report, which exposed the fact that doctors and health staff in Mutitjulu were prescribing Viagra to a man who was abusing children.
Didn't fit with
the narrative, yeah. So they just didn't tell anyone. They just kept it out.
So you got the same documents then?
Well, no. Here's the irony. Yeah. They put that document... This is the arrogance of Lateline. They put that document on the screen to say, we got a leaked report that said blah, 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 blah. And they put the report up on their screen. At the time, I had a 60-inch television, which was big for the day. That's a big screen
still
at the
is.
Time. Well, it is. Yeah, it still is. But this was 10 years ago, so that was a big television.
Must have been doing all right.
Yeah. The bank owned it. And I was going through the story, and I paused it on that report, and I was looking at the... I could just read the writing because the screen was so big. And I could see the word Viagra, and I'm thinking, hang on a minute. They're describing this report as backing the claim that Aboriginal men created an environment where children are being abused. Why is the word Viagra in the report? And we were able to transcribe the report from the television screen, and it revealed that Lateline was warned about the fact that a doctor in the community was prescribing Viagra. Not only did they not tell their listeners about that, but they put the very doctor on who was doing it, who blamed Aboriginal people for the problem. So there were a host of other problems with the story. The biggest one probably was the fact that they never visited Mutitjulu in the making of the story. They literally never even went there. They stitched together footage from other communities and some from Mutitjulu, but they tried to portray that they'd been to Mutitjulu. They even had a reenactment of a scene which they tried to pretend was in Mutitjulu, which it wasn't. It was in Alice Springs. So they tried very hard to convince you that they went to Mutitjulu, but they never did. And they've acknowledged that since. Everything I'm telling you has been acknowledged. They're not denying it. But they'll say there's excuses for it. The upshot was that that story, which sparked the Little Children of Sacred report, undeniably, was a complete fiction. There were many, many, many more problems with it. They broadcast that one Aboriginal man was violent and had a history of assaulting women. What they didn't tell you was that it was they were describing spent convictions which were almost 40 years old and related to an assault against a woman where this guy pushed a woman out of his car because he says she was causing trouble in the car.
Chris, this brings to mind, you know, when people hear, you know, people like yourself talk out against the intervention, you know, one of the criticisms that people might say is that, well, are you just trying to say that these communities are perfect?
They're not perfect.
Or that there are no issues in these communities. Are you trying to cover up?
Yeah. They're not perfect. There were aspects of broad truth around Lateline's reporting, but they decimated the Mutitjulu community because what they reported was absolute lies. There is undeniably greater levels of neglect and abuse in Northern Territory Aboriginal communities. That's undeniable. It's also not surprising. If you underfund any community, be it white or black, for decades, and you don't even give it basic services, then you're going to have neglect. You're going to have neglected children because you have neglected adults. It's an undeniable path that, well, it's an undeniable outcome. Yeah, everybody in these communities is neglected, not just the children. Sexual abuse is higher in remote Aboriginal communities than it is in non-Aboriginal communities. There's simple reasons for that, not least of all, if you cram 20 or 30 people into a house and you introduce one sexual predator, that sexual predator has access to a substantial number more children. Whereas if you introduce a sexual predator into a house in Brisbane, they might have access to 2.2 children. So, of course, rates are going to be higher. Throw in alcohol abuse, which is in some communities a problem. In a lot of communities it's not. In a lot of communities they're dry.
And it's not to say that these things don't exist, but
they do
in
exist.
This particular circumstance, the
story was fabrication. Yeah. It was an undeniable fabrication. And there are problems in Mutitjulu, like there are in many Aboriginal communities.
There are in many non-Indigenous communities.
Many non-Aboriginal communities. There's undoubtedly sexual violence in Mutitjulu, like there is in every Australian community, undeniably. But what it fundamentally did was cast Aboriginal people in a particular way, and they launched the intervention, and the net result has been disastrous. They haven't increased school attendance rates. The self-harm attempt suicide rate more than quadrupled after the intervention. A Senate inquiry found widespread starvation in Aboriginal communities immediately after the intervention. Anemia rates in children spiked as a result of the Northern Territory intervention. The jarning rate has increased. It's now, the Northern Territory has one of the highest jarning rates in the world. Western Australia has the highest Indigenous jarning rate in the world. But as Noel Pearson recently pointed out on Q&A, Indigenous Australians are the world's most jarred people. Anywhere on earth, Northern Territory's got a large part to play in that. Their jarling rate, I think at the last count, was 7 to 8 times greater than the jarling rate of black males under apartheid South Africa. Like 8 times worse than the most racist nation on earth. That's the Northern Territory. The number of children, I think it's 96% of youth offenders in Northern Territory are Aboriginal, and 86 or 87% of adult offenders are Aboriginal. Make up less than 1/3 of the population. So the question is,
10 years on, what's
changed? Nothing. I mean, none of those things have improved. Overcrowding is still a massive problem. They've relieved overcrowding by less than 0.1%.
I remember in the years just after the intervention, there was this huge
not 1%, but anyway.
Huge, but there was an investment in housing, and it was a complete...
disaster. We broke that story as well. We got leaked a memo. They'd spent $150 million.
And built something like...
Zero.
Houses.
Zero houses. They spent $150 million.
That's criminal.
It is.
And we talk about the stigma and all the things that happened out of that report to Aboriginal people as well as communities.
Yeah.
You have $150 million that is invested for building houses in these communities.
Didn't build one.
Not one.
Not one.
And where's the outrage?
Yeah, look, they did eventually build some houses. That was the SIHIP program, the Strategic Initiatives Housing, and the Strategic Indigenous Housing Initiatives Program. It was the $700 million plank of the Northern Territory intervention. It was supposed to relieve overcrowding. It never did. They took the average number per dwelling down, I think, from 10.9 to 10.8. I mean, it was still outrageous. And those houses today, a decade on, will be run down. If you cram 30 people into a house, imagine how long that house is going to last. It's not going to last very long at all. It was a disaster, and they killed people, they harmed people, they harmed children, and the legislation is still in place. It was put in place for a further 10 years by Labor, not by the Liberals. So,
well, we still see the remnants now. The last budget, they announced the basics card for non-Indigenous communities.
That was that was tested out on Aboriginal people in the Northern Territory intervention. Cost hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to implement. This notion that Aboriginal people were the big... windfall winners out of the intervention is rubbish. It was an unmitigated disaster, and the question people need to ask themselves is, if this was done to a white community, if you killed children and caused starvation and anemia rates and school attendance drop, what would happen to government if that happened to a white community?
Very important question, one we don't ask enough. Chris Graham, thanks for joining us this morning, mate.
Pleasure as always.
Good to catch up, and we'll speak to you tomorrow on Let's Talk. Make sure you join us.